Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her website's JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Is household insurance becoming unaffordable? We have all these natural disasters, Southern California, mudslides, forest fires last year. Allstate and Farmers will not insure people anymore in California if they're a new customer. Is this a crisis?
Well, I think it's going that way. I'm actually very concerned about this issue. I don't think that many people are paying attention to it yet. You know, it's a function of, as you say, the extreme weather events. It's also a function of the fact that people have put so much capital into their homes in the past couple of decades, where the values have increased so much. And, you know, the amount of fancy details, equipment, and, you know, things that make it expensive to replace, all of that has gone along with the low interest rate environment where we were pounding more capital into that sector. And now you've got, as you say, a lot of companies are starting to pull back, either not offering coverage at all, which is really shocking, or they are, you know, doubling and tripling premiums and deductibles such that people are finding it cost prohibitive. And here's the real kicker, Jim. You can't get, it's one thing to self-insure, which is horrifying for owners. You know, if you have most of your net worth in real estate and you can't get insurance to cover the replacement cost, that's a very sobering idea. The other part of that is, of course, if you haven't got your house paid for or you need financing to purchase a home, you can't get a mortgage unless you can get insurance. And the same goes with renewals, you know. So if you have an existing mortgage and suddenly your insurer pulls out of the area or says they won't renew your contract, now you've got a problem because your mortgage is dependent upon, the renewal is dependent upon continuing to have that coverage. So there's been, you know, I put a couple of stories on the blog in the last little while, and one recently was the CNBC coverage of the woman who was saying, you know, and that's in places like California, where, but it's Florida, it's lots of places. Even in BC, there's areas where insurance companies are pulling out. And, you know, the thing that really stood out for me from that story about the couple in the in California is that they had owned the house for, I think they said 18 years. They'd bought it for $400,000 and they still owed something like $370,000 on it. So this was a major problem that they, you know, their insurance quote was going to be something like $12,000 a year and they couldn't afford that. So they were saying, you know, if we can't have insurance, we can't be, we can't have our mortgage and this is all a problem. The other thing that really struck me though is that you've lived in a house for 18 years and you've paid off the mortgage almost none. You know, like their equity in the house was so little. And that speaks to this other problem of people have been gutting the equity out of their homes repeatedly in the past many years. It's been a very prominent activity where because the price of real estate was rising, when it came to, you know, a shortfall in one's spending aspirations or bills relative to their income, people just rolled those that amount onto their mortgage. And so the net effect was we've got a lot of older people today that should have their house paid off, but they in fact don't. And that goes back to this behavior that was engendered by, you know, abnormally high appreciation in the pricing of real estate, but also, you know, now, as we say, this climactic impact being such that it's very difficult to get renewals. So I think this is going to really be a sobering impact on how people think about their real estate. I mean, there are people that have several properties, you know, whether it's chalets and a cottage and a house, and imagine, you know, the bulk of their net worth, even if they have one house, is in this asset. And if it's so exposed to risk that no one is going to give you any coverage for it, or you can't afford the coverage for it, that's a really significant development. And I think that that may incline some people to sell their properties or downsize their properties or go to more distributed or diversified. You know, maybe you have much, you know, instead of one big house somewhere, you have a couple of small properties that are a lot cheaper to replace. And, you know, if one gets wiped out in a storm or a terrible, you know, weather event, you have another place to be. So I really think this could shape the way people feel about real estate in general. The other factor, Jim, about insurance, of course, is it's not just housing and property insurance. It's also auto insurance. You know, we have a 50% increase in the last 2 years in the amount of auto theft that's happened in Ontario and Quebec. And there's a meeting today in Ottawa going on with respect to what to do about this with law enforcement agencies, because it has become organized crime has really just taken over in this sector. And, you know, I know several people in Ontario who have had their cars stolen right out of their driveway, repeatedly in some cases. And that's in places like Toronto. So the thing here is, again, who's bearing the cost of this? If we constantly are making claims to replace the asset, obviously, the way insurance works, we're going to have a collective increase in the cost of having that insurance. And indeed, it may be cost prohibitive in many cases. So again, this is all part of this, these effects of, I think we've really come to a time in the world. Insurance was a really novel concept when it first came in, this sharing of risk idea, and it's been so important in many of the decisions that we've made over the past many decades. The thing is, though, and it goes with health insurance as well, frankly, if you know that no matter how sick you get, you're going to have, you know, health coverage that's going to give you whatever medical treatment or drugs or, you know, support you need, you are less inclined to worry about your health, right? So, I mean, not for everyone, but for a majority of people, they don't really think about their health in the terms of what is their responsibility in terms of maintaining it or self-insuring, so to speak. Now, in many places where people don't have health coverage or insurance coverage, you know, in the United States, for example, it's one of the most largest drivers of bankruptcy is having a health problem that comes up where you can't, don't have coverage, and you end up, you know, having to spend all any equity you can get or money you can get to try and treat yourself or your loved one. So anyway, there's just this theme that's developing of insurance not being as affordable or accessible or prevalent as we've taken for granted in the past many decades. And I think that this could really shift people's behavior back to a greater self-reliance and concern about how to diversify their risk personally.
Now, with the car insurance, these vehicles are being put in shipping containers, and CBC Marketplace has tracked them down to places in Africa who aren't interested in sending those cars back. Is this a multi-jurisdictional problem?
Oh, yeah, it's huge. I mean, this is, I think, why they're having this conference in Ottawa today, because, you know, there's various suggestions been made about how to try and track them, but it's quite a complex issue, and I think it's really gone rampant. So it's got, you know, well established in the way that it's been spreading, and the way that they've got all these, you know, lines now that just take cars directly into the, as you say, the shipping containers and directly out of places like Montreal. But I think, as I said, it, in a world where insurance is not available or is cost prohibitive, or, you know, where deductibles, if your car is stolen, are so high, I think the outrage really begins to climb and people will start insisting that more be done to try and curtail this. And I think we're at that point right now.
The sad part of the CBC story was the person they were doing the story on had put a tracker in their vehicle. They even called the police and said, it's right here. Go get it. And the police didn't seem to be interested at all.
Yeah, I saw that as well. There is definitely, I also know of people who have had their identity stolen through hacks. And they have tracked down cars that have been purchased in their name with their ID. There's been car insurance taken out on them, et cetera. And when they bring that to the attention of the police say, you know, they can't do anything about, you know, in one case, the person tracked down the car and said, it's sitting here, this car that was illegally purchased in my name. And the police have said, you know, well, we just can't do anything. So obviously there's some new initiatives required, and I think that we're getting to a tipping point here where the tolerance is going to be much less than it has been to date.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, will the Fed cut rates this year, or will they just leave them where they are?
Well, if you, Jerome Powell was on 60 Minutes, of course, on Sunday, and was speaking about the expectation that indeed the Fed will be cutting rates in 24. That is the base case. He thinks perhaps 75 basis points, you know, a maximum of 3 times of 25 basis points. So that would take the overnight rate, but down from, you know, 5.5 to 4.75 kind of thing. But that's not a for sure, you know, definite development. It requires there not to be any sort of shock or something that comes out of nowhere, like another war or, you know, a pandemic or any of these things that have happened that people weren't expecting that suddenly cause a spike in inflation and that sort of thing. But barring any of that, the other thing that comes to mind to me is some kind of stress in the banking system. And I've been tracking very carefully developments in the commercial real estate market, defaults in terms of delinquencies on loans for companies as well as for households, and the threats this brings to banks. So you know, it's interesting that, and Powell actually acknowledged this, as did Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was speaking recently and said that the commercial real estate market could certainly pose a systemic threat. And it's because, again, during the low era rate, the low rate era, the low interest rate era, the decade or so that was from, you know, 2010 certainly into 22, so 12 years, there was so much cash piling into these quote-unquote no-brainer ideas of real estate, and that goes for households as well as commercial, but there was a lot of, you know, irresponsible lending, frankly, against properties, not enough math being done. And now what's happening, of course, not just in the office sector, which has seen a huge drop in occupancy, but in a lot of the commercial properties that were, as I say, levered up at all-time highs and drove up the price while that was happening. And now when people are looking to liquidate or sell, properties are trading for, you know, huge discounts from 25 to 50%, some even more than that in major cities across America. And so, of course, there's losses piling up in terms of the lenders because, especially in the commercial space, the owners are more inclined to just hand the keys over and walk away. And so there's you'll notice that although we've had a rebound since October in the stock market in a handful of companies, the regional banks, in fact, in the United States are negative year to date. The financials are negative year to date overall, not just the regional banks, but the overall banks. And the sectors, the smaller, more economically sensitive companies in the Russell 2000 or the S&P 600 or any of these baskets, they're all actually still negative year to date. And we're seeing a similar wave going across in China, which I've been writing about, because I think it's a example or a precursor, a warning to how all of these factors can come together and really create a cyclone of bad news in terms of for the financial sector, for the real estate sector all at once. And that's exactly what's been happening in China, where, you know, the property market has been in a slump now for more than 2 years, and it just continues to fall. And the government is really not trying to step in and backstop it in any significant way, because I think they realize that so much capacity was, overcapacity was built during the easy money era. And they've got these ghost buildings that nobody wants, and a lot of apartments, too much supply. They've got a very aging, shrinking demographic there, and they've got this massive amount of stock now that people can't afford to live in or can't afford to buy. You know, they had that whole obsession with pre-ordering, just like we've seen in parts of Canada. So anyway, I think there's a very real chance that the central banks could cut more than presently imagined in response to a spreading banking crisis or contagion that could flow from the interconnection between real estate and lenders. And barring that, if that doesn't happen, then, you know, a more just a general moderation in the pace of inflation is expected to make central banks start to cut. Now, they always assume a very orderly cutting process. In my experience of the last 25 years, when they start to cut, they're more inclined to panic because they're reactionary. They do it in response to declining economic data or surging defaults or surging unemployment or destabilization starts to happen in a particular part of the economy or financial market, and then they sort of try and stem or support confidence by stepping in and saying, don't worry, we've got this. And again, if you look at what the Chinese central bank has been doing, there's been, you know, because again, there's a lot of unrest, there's a lot of youth unemployment in that country, and it really has suffered greatly. If you look at the commodities sector, commodities index, the CRB, which is again very correlated or had been with Chinese demand in building out all these properties and infrastructure over the past, you know, 12 years since the great financial crisis, certainly China really rode to the rescue and, you know, through a lot of debt financing, built out that sector, which drove commodity demand globally. But you see the commodity index has actually been flat for 2 years here. And that really, if you look at the Chinese stock market again, it's part of this same inflation deflation thing where it went into a bubble, as did the property market, and all this mania around this belief that China would constantly stimulate and be able to continually drive world demand. And in fact, that hasn't panned out. And now stocks have been in a free fall, like Hong Kong shares back to where they were in 2005, Jim. And the CSI 300, which is the Chinese basket of shares, has been slumping as well. So just, you know, at multi-year lows. And that's with central banks already starting to cut rates there. With even today, the Chinese government has stepped in to start buying ETFs again of like Chinese stocks, again as a gimmick to try and boost support or think, you know, make people think that the bottom's in, so they step in trying to buy the ETFs. They've done this a couple of times though, and it always mean reverts right after that, because it's a Ponzi scheme. You know, ultimately that's what it is. If the government has to, you know, step in and buy things to try and keep the prices up, that's not actual real demand or investor demand or consumption or legitimate demand. That's just fabricated. So it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, what central banks end up doing this year, and some of these wild cards will really dictate the speed at which they will react. But the ultimate thing is that they, you know, it's pushing on a string when the world is in so much debt, when, you know, as I say, interest rates are not going to be back to zero, even if they cut, you know, significantly in 2024. And we've got a wall of maturities coming up where companies and households are, you know, there's like a $500 trillion of commercial real estate debt coming up for renewal in 24 and 25. And those rates of interest that they're facing are, you know, 2, 3, 4% higher than what the existing loans were at. Well, that's all very significant in terms of an increase in cost. And that's going to drive more, I think, rationalization of costs and expenses on other things like the labor force, which we're really seeing in spades now, where a lot of layoff announcements keep coming day after day after day. And that's where companies are just realizing, you know, our financing costs have risen so significantly or are about to, and we have to do something to lower the costs in every other way that we can. So that means less business investment, less employment. And that's really another factor that's likely to weigh on the economy this year, for sure.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at House Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.